is the session on creativity with children, singing the Lord's Song of Children. And I'm Lois Brokering, the designated leader. I don't know why you're all so far away from me. Do I have BO this morning or something? I don't like this blank space. People coming in late are going to have to sit here. Mary has asked that we push books that we put into the store that fit our sessions and so on. And this book is not, it's not a book to work with children. It is a book to develop your own creativity. And if you're doing teacher training in your churches or schools anywhere, this is a big help. It's by my husband, Herb. It's called Holy Holy, and it is in the bookstore. I'm sure Mary would just love it if you'd all put one in your suitcase to go home, and Herb and I would also love it. You probably need to stop at the cash register before you do that, yes. At any rate, it has a lot of input as far as little vignettes and then exercises that you can do to help you get your creative juices flowing. So I think you might enjoy that. Well, why is creativity a subject to do with singing the Lord's Song with children? I think you've all read the chapter and verse in the Bible that talks about us being created in the Lord's image. And we also know that God is our creator, and he has won over us because he can create what is the Latin term, ex nihilo or something? He can create out of nothing. None of us can do that. But I, through the years that I've worked with children, have begun to realize that children come to us highly creative, just highly creative. And I think it's the process of socialization that somehow milks this dry, so that by the time we get to be the age that we are gathered in this room, if I went around and said to you, are you creative? Most of you would say, oh no, I'm not creative. And we really believe this of ourselves. For many years, I came up here and worked in the crafts room. And it was really an interesting experience because I was teaching kindergarten at the same time. And when I switched from working with five-year-olds to adults, the difference in the creativity level went zonk. people would come in here and just, they wanted patterns. They wanted to be told how to do it. And what we tried to do is to get people to say, you know, put the village on this piece of burlap with yarn the way you envision it. Not, you know, we don't have any ready-made patterns here. You can, if you want to buy a kit, you can do that all over the place. But I often wonder why they refer in the department stores to this area in the store as the creative stitchery place, because the only person who was really creative was Erica Wilson, or you know, whoever the gal was who got to design this thing. You just finish it. You know, it's fun. It's fun to do it. When you get done, you have a sense of having accomplished something. But in the true sense of creativity, it's not really all that creative, because somebody else thought it up. Usually they've even decided what colors you're going to use. You can't even pick that. You have to follow the design so closely. So that's not the kind of creativity that I want to talk about this morning. There's always such a divergence of opinion on what creativity actually is. And I've designed some little games that I use with my students. Maybe I should explain, because there are a lot of you that are new in the village and weren't with us last time. I train teachers for one of the things I do. I train teachers in Minneapolis of young children. And these are people who are already teaching, and they have to have in-service, which is a real hassle, because a lot of them aren't all that motivated. They have to have these credits in order to keep their jobs, and that's why some people come. They don't care if they're growing professionally or personally, but that's just some of them. But anyway, it makes me have to think of, you know, clever ways of getting them to think about this information. And I don't know how clever this is, but it's something I came up with, and I hope you enjoy it as much as some of the other people do that have used this. I've used these little envelopes with hundreds of people. I've used them in Phoenix, Arizona, and Billings, Montana, and Berchtesgaden, Germany, and Kyoto, Japan. I guess I didn't use them in Tokyo. Anyway, I'm going to pass them around. And when you get yours, you can take out the contents, and you don't have a desk, but if you have any kind of lap or anything, sort of lay them out in front of you and see what you've got. But since I've used them so many times, I want to ask you to try to get them all back into the same envelope you get them out of, because I'd like to use them many times again. Now, the things that are in the envelope are very simple little things that you could use with small children. In fact, It's really interesting for me to use these with a group like you, and I'm used to using them with preschool teachers, because preschool teachers are used to the contents of this envelope, and they're used to doing things with this, and they just zip right to it, whereas parents seem to find these very foreign objects. I see a kindergarten teacher already making something with them. So lay them out in front of you, and then we'll take a look at them.
Just a diagram, and I want to do this one.
It's probably somebody's notes from a former session. Tape needs to be turned off. All got them arranged, okay? All right, now, how did it make you feel when I first started to scold her?
You're terrible.
I'm terrible. Or she's terrible.
Well, I think
you're terrible. Okay. Did any of the rest of you have an immediate sort of gut level? What? How did you feel?
That's not fair.
That's not fair. Yeah. You felt sorry for her. Anybody else? How did you feel? You felt sorry for her. Anybody else?
Well, she's pretty lucky.
Why did you think she was lucky? Because I was noticing her?
She was going to be an example.
Oh, I see. And you would like to be the shining star that the teacher...
I don't want to be lucky.
I wonder why you chose the term lucky.
I don't know. I just felt that.
When I do this with classes of teachers, I usually try to lower my voice when I give those directions so that somebody's off guard and doesn't catch them. Now, does that happen when you give directions to children at
and
home?
You said or it fast.
And I said it fast. Yeah, I deliberately did that to catch you on guard. Now, I don't think teachers and parents deliberately do things to catch kids off guard, but I think that we do things as we go along that kids are not tuned in. You know, does that ever happen to us in adult-adult relationships? All the time, doesn't it? You don't catch it. But when it's an adult-to-adult and you say, I didn't hear it, sometimes, unless it's some superior, they will repeat it. But how about when you tell it to a kid and they don't get it? You know, now why didn't she get it? Why did she do it wrong? You know, do you ever stop when a child does something wrong to figure that out? Why did this child not do it right? Is he not paying attention? You know, if he's not paying attention, there might be two reasons. I had a child one time that was forever getting in fights at school. And I discovered that if I went to him as an individual and explained what it was that needed to be done, he was fine. But if I explained to the whole group, he never could do it. And I was beginning to think, gee, this child is really not with it. All of a sudden it dawned on me, he's getting it. He does good, high, average quality work if I go over and explain to him what's to be done. But if I'm over here and he's over there, he's not getting it. Now that gave me a clue. What do you think it was? He's got a hearing problem. That child had an 80% hearing loss. Now, would that be fair for me to scold him like I did Judy? Yeah. Do any of you remember that happening in elementary school? You know, usually when I do this, the whole group kind of, you know, gets a gut level kind of thing for a minute, and then they realize, that's not her. Why is she doing this? I one time had a student who went like this when I attacked another student. And I said to her, why did you? She said, I was afraid you're going to pick on me next, and I was going to hide it. Another time a girl changed her. She just quickly changed her, and hers was correct. But she changed it because she was so afraid, one's wrong, you know. And we're so geared into finding the right answer for that the authority figure wants that we have these gut level things. But you see, all those feelings that you had, those are on an affective level, aren't they? They're on an affective level. We're talking about an intellectual level now. We're not talking about feelings. But do they intermesh? That's right. That's right. How much do you remember when there's negative affect put on it? See, sometimes you remember the wrong things. So if you want kids to really think well, you've got to lift the level of the affect. You've got to make it positive, which means you don't go around attacking people when they make a mistake. You think to yourself, you know, wonder why she made that mistake. If she wasn't paying attention, then how can I, as the teacher or the parent, help her to be more attentive so she doesn't miss out on stuff? Is scolding going to do it? Is drawing attention going to do it? Is making the child responsible for the results going to do it? And if you do that, how do you do it so that it's positive affect rather than negative affect? Those are real important questions to ask, and we can't get into them very deeply with a 45-minute session, but I'd like to at least have you think about those things. What does negative affect do to our ability to remember the information that's taking in, or to even take it in? Even to take it in. Kids tend to take in the information that they get rewarded for taking in, because that's where their moral development level is. You see, so how do you reward a kid for taking in, you know, all the information that's available? How do you do that? That's not easy. And we can talk more about that as the week goes on. Okay, what you just did was convergent thinking. There is only one right answer to this, isn't there? If I had said to you, well, okay, Gary has another answer. Here, he's got the squares on top of each other, okay? You could arrange them diagonally, or you could do them this way. See, they're sequenced, but they're upside down. Supposing he had started with a little one. I didn't tell you. No, yes, I did. I told you left to right, large to small, didn't I? So, this way it's hard to tell if it's large to small, because you might start on top and go down. How do you know that? That's why I said left to right. So there's just one way that these squares should look if you did it correctly, and that's convergent thinking. Okay, there's another kind of thinking that you could use these shapes. This time, instead of me giving you a very specific way to arrange them, let me say to you, make a picture of something real with the shapes. Okay? Okay, you do that now. Whatever you choose now is called divergent thinking, because I asked you to think of as many different things as you could think of with those shapes. See, before I gave you one very specific way to arrange them, and it was either right or wrong. Now, anything you arranged was right, wasn't it? Were there any wrong answers in what you did? Okay, that is the difference between convergent thinking and divergent thinking. Now, when you're working with children, whether they're your own kids or the neighbor's kids, or even when you're working with yourself, it really pays to expect children to first think divergently before they come up with the right answer, except for some things. There's a whole list of stuff in which there aren't multiple answers. If you want to teach kids the alphabet, or you want to teach kids how to communicate, I should say, with the rest of their culture, you have to teach them the alphabet the way it has always been taught. There's no way that you can say to me, oh, what's your name? And I say, oh, here's my name. You know what my name is? Well, why not? That's the way I've decided to write my name. You know, and can I think divergently and say, you know, if I want to write my name that way, then that's correct. See, that's a time when it is not appropriate to think divergently, because it doesn't communicate to you, and that is the purpose of writing my name, is to communicate it, right? So if you're going to teach, there are three kinds of knowledge that you can be sure to use convergent thinking, where there is probably one right answer. The first thing is natural knowledge. Now, that's kind of a weird one, because there are probably right answers in natural knowledge. The problem is finding them. You see, there was a day, if you remember, you don't remember, but there was a day when people thought the earth was flat. And if the true-false question on the science test was, the earth is round or flat, A or B, and you put round, you were wrong, because people really believed that it was flat. I heard a professor addressing the graduating medical school class from one of the Ivy League colleges over the radio one time, and he said, what we have taught you in your 4 years of medical school is not true. I thought that was a great comfort. He said, unfortunately, we do not know which 50%. So you see, in natural knowledge, we're constantly finding new truths all the time and disputing things that we formerly thought were true. But that doesn't mean that there aren't correct answers there that we have to be hunting for, because they are correct. And there aren't two. I mean, one of the things in natural knowledge, for instance, is mathematical knowledge. And I can't get up some morning and say, oh, I'm so tired of 2 and 2 being 4. They were 4 yesterday and the day before. It's just really a bore. I think today I'll have it be 7 would be nice. Because 2 and 2 are not going to be 7, no matter what I do. It doesn't matter what culture you're in, what language you speak. This many things and this many things is this many things, no matter whether you label them fear or 4 or quattro.
On the base of the number system that you're using.
That's true. But that's a different label then, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, natural knowledge then includes scientific facts, mathematical facts. Another thing that is that has one answer is historic knowledge. Now here again we get in trouble because if we suddenly heard a scream and we all looked out there and there was some dreadful accident occurring, a bear was chewing up somebody, and later on we were all asked to give an account of what we saw, we would all give a different account, wouldn't we? I mean, some of us were sitting so that the bear was hidden by the window, and we said, well, I saw this girl out there screaming, but I don't know what she was screaming about. It wasn't anything. There was no bear. I didn't see a bear. Well, because the bear was hidden by the building. Somebody else was looking and seeing just the bear, and the girl would be cut off by the building. So, you know, historic knowledge is very, very clouded by our ability to perceive our point of view, our past experiences, where we happened to be at the time, and so on. However, there is fact there, isn't there? I mean, something really did happen, but getting at it is the problem. There's one other category of knowledge that has right and wrong answers, and that's arbitrary knowledge. For instance, I think it would be much nicer living in Minnesota to have Christmas in the middle of February instead of at the end of December. I mean, in December, winter is just starting, and we sort of think it's fun to have winter. But by the middle of February, we're all kind of fed up with, you're Minnesotans, aren't you? Aren't you kind of tired of winter by then? You know, the skiing fun is worn off, and the kids are tired of their sleds and so on. Then I think it would be really neat to have a big celebration and, you know, gear it all up again. But I can't say to my family, well, you know, we'll have Christmas February 13th instead of, let's have it on Valentine's Day instead of on Christmas. Now, you know, the world can go their way. It doesn't work. There will be no Christmas carols on the radio. There will be no church service on February 12th at midnight or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, nobody else is celebrating it, so I can't personally decide I'm going to change that. That is arbitrary knowledge. So, you know, there are all kinds of things that by consensus or by decree have been decided by somebody or other, and we have to teach children those facts if we're going to help them. The reason that's called arbitrary is because it's changeable. It can be changed by congressional decree, for instance. We used to celebrate, what was it, 4th of July on the 4th of July. We now celebrate it on either the Monday or the Friday closest to the 4th of July so we can all have a longer weekend. So, you know, it can be changed. Manners are changing. I went to pick up my son one time and went to his senior recital with him, and afterwards to celebrate, Herb and I took him and his girlfriend out to dinner. We finished dinner, we came out on the sidewalk. My son opened the car door and he got in. I was standing there dumbfounded. I said, John Brooklyn, what's going on? Abby and I are standing on the sidewalk. You know, you hold the door while we got in. What are you doing? I was just dumbfounded. He looked at me with this most innocent look and said, well, I held the door for Doris last week, and she said, John Brooklyn, if you ever do that again, I'll never speak to you. So you see, you know, those manners are arbitrary and they are changing. There was a time when women thought it was very nice to have men hold doors. There are apparently now young women who think that's a big insult to have a door held. I can hold the door myself. I don't need some man holding a door for me. So, you know, that sort of arbitrary knowledge shifts with the tides or can be changed. All right, now, there is a third kind of thinking, or a fourth kind. Now, this I never know whether to label 3 and 4 or 4 and 3 or how it goes, because if there is more than one answer, and I want to say that everything that doesn't fall in those three categories has more than one answer. And yet think of how much stuff we tell kids as though there is one right answer and it's the one I know. I mean, think about that. Think of all the stuff that parents and teachers laid on you. Think of, here's a real blatant example, the art class. Somebody was telling the other day about someone who was working in Narnia, I don't know who it is, who was having such a marvelous time doing these art projects because in elementary school, this person was convinced that she didn't like art because she never could do it right. Now, you know, how can an elementary teacher convince a child that their art is wrong? If you go to any good art museum, you'll find there are 10 million ways to paint a tree. Isn't that right? You know, have you ever gone to an art institute in some big city? How many different ways, if you compare, for instance, Rubens with Picasso? The difference is like night and day. Which one is right? You know, the one that comes closest to a photograph? Well, Picasso wouldn't be all that famous. We wouldn't have all flocked out and paid umpteen dollars to see his exhibit when it came to the Minneapolis Art Institute some years ago if that were the criteria, you see. So when you're working with kids, the clue is when there isn't one answer, when it's not in one of these three categories, then try to get them to think of as many ways as they can to solve a problem or to make a decision, because this helps them learn to think. But there's one thing missing, and I think this is where we fall down. I mean, lots of people are now helping children do divergent thinking, but where it falls down is that the adult does the evaluating, and that's the fifth thinking skill.
Evaluation.
Now, supposing I said to you, out of all those little things you made with the shapes a little bit ago when you were doing divergent thinking, which of them best fit the category transportation?
Train.
A train? A truck? A bicycle? Okay. Why didn't the house fit? It doesn't what?
It doesn't move by itself.
It doesn't move by itself. So that doesn't fit the category transportation, does it? All right, what you're doing now is the fifth thinking skill. You're evaluating. Why didn't the house fit? Why didn't the little person fit? You know, they have nothing to do with transportation. Although one time someone had not made any kind of vehicle, and they said the person was the thing that they made that came closest to fitting that category, because a person does at least move or drive a car or a truck or something. So, you know, that out of all the things she made, that best fit the category, even though it wasn't a good fit. And that's another clue with evaluative thinking, with divergent thinking. Very often, I think, especially when we're working with kids, we're in a big hurry, we adults. We want them to find the right answer or the best answer right away. And the longer I live, the more I see that one cannot hurry right answers or good answers or better answers. What children need to learn is sometimes there is not a good solution. Sometimes there's that. Look at the Second World War. You know, was that sending all those tanks and guns and young men over there to get slaughtered? You know, was that really a super duper thing to do? You know, do any of you really believe, gosh, why don't we do that again? That was so neat, you know. No, everybody's trying to think of ways to avoid doing that again. Well, why did we do it? It was because it was the best solution we could find to what was going on in the world at that time. But whether it was an excellent solution, you know, I don't think anybody disputed that. That was not an excellent solution. But it was the best thing anybody could come up with. Well, they had let things go too far to do it diplomatically. Somebody had too much power and might now, and it was just too far down the tube. And sometimes that happens to children. And then we compromise and we do something we don't believe in. I wouldn't recommend that as a way for working with kids, but that does happen in the world, and sometimes kids have to know that that is what has happened. This is what somebody else thought was the best solution. Let's see if we can think of a better way that it could have been done. And maybe one of the better ways is preventive. You know, what when you get a cavity in your tooth, the best solution is to let the dentist drill it out. But maybe a better solution would have been to take better care of the teeth before the cavity arrived. Well, it's too late to think of that now. But let's think of it for the future then, so you get some problem solving that way. Another thing I think we need to teach children is how to live in ambiguity. You see, the problem is not going to be solved overnight. Look at our energy crisis problem. How fast are we solving that? It's probably going to take us decades. And we are doing divergent thinking on that, aren't we? You know, some places are finding geothermal is a good way to go. Well, that wouldn't do in Minnesota because we just don't have any of that steam. But up in Iceland, that's a fantastic solution. They've got heat just pouring out all over the place, and all they do is put it in great big containers and pipe it into the homes. You don't see a chimney on the island. It's just a marvelous solution. In fact, they've got so much geothermal energy in Iceland that they are bringing raw materials from all over the world and using it to manufacture goods because it's just going to waste. It's just Wind power might be okay if you live in North Dakota, but it doesn't do very well probably right here, where there isn't that much wind most of the time. So, you know, there are many solutions to those problems, and we need to learn to live in ambiguity with them because we don't know what's going to be the best solution ultimately. And probably there will not be a solution to that problem. So we will never move down to convergent thinking. Now, you know, how does this apply to what we're doing with kids? Most of what traditional schooling that you and I had as kids maybe has done, and I think we finally have moved away from this, and I guess it's like a pendulum swinging, because when you think about education when the country was first started, kids didn't spend a lot of time in school. They just spent a little bit of time in school, and when they went to school, they only learned things in that bottom category. You know, they learned the three R's. And the rest of the stuff, they learned by being with their parents. How did you learn how to farm? You learned to farm by being with your dad when he said, well, you know, I think the ground's getting warm enough today to put the seeds out. Well, why is it warm enough today, Dad? You see, you learned it how? By modeling and by doing. Then you went and you did it with him. You helped him. And you learned, well, how warm is the soil? You know, how deep is the frost yet that we can now put the seeds in? And you know, if we blew that, what happens? Well, they don't come up yet. How do we guess? How did you learn how to cook in those days? I once came across my mother's beginning cookbook, the one she took with her as a bride. My gosh, if you didn't already know how to cook, forget it. You use a lump of butter the size of a walnut. Well, but which size walnut? It didn't say, you know. So you had to guess. So in other words, you had to know how to cook. Well, where did you learn how to cook? You learned how to cook by watching your mother and by doing it with her. So it was more by modeling and by doing. Now, one of the neat things about learning that you'll discover as you watch Jacob progress, and the rest of you maybe have observed with children that are older, is that the first learning we do is on an object level. It's a real experience. And I like to think of learning as a bookcase. I don't know about you, but this has been helpful to me. It really provides chocolate, no eraser here. I like to think of learning as a three-tiered bookshelf, okay? Well, I'll get my bookshelf to go. On the bottom level is a real thing. And I should have gone over to the kitchen maybe and gotten a real thing, but I like to use a tomato or a pumpkin. Let's suppose that you've come in here today and that the object of our session this morning is to learn about tomato-ness. And I had, you know, well, let's suppose we went to the kitchen instead of into Koinonia, and we had, you know, each had a whole basket of tomatoes, and you had all kinds of equipment. You had knives and, you know, a stove and some saucepans and forks and anything you wanted to find out about tomato-ness. And you could do anything you wanted, and when you damaged one tomato by finding out about it, you could take another one. What could you find out about tomatoes? Now you're drawing on your memory because you've all had many, many experiences with tomatoes. What could you find out if I gave you all these tomatoes to play with and do whatever you wanted with?
They're soft.
They're soft.
Round.
They're round.
Red.
They're red.
Seeds.
They're juicy. They have seeds.
The
seeds will squirt out if you do the right thing.
Bad.
It tastes bad. Okay, will everybody find that? Is anybody, are you all going to find out that it tastes bad?
Well,
see now, huh? We have a divergency of opinion. Who is right?
I am.
Are you right?
He's got strange taste.
Now, see, this is what happens in classrooms, isn't it? The teacher will say, or in the home, but it's really good. He's wrong. And she's saying, he's strange. And see, the kid who thinks divergently, what happens? Mm-hmm. And they begin to get an image of themselves as somebody who's different and unusual, and that's not too good, is it? You know, I mean, if we carry this to the extreme that kids do, how would you begin to feel?
It's all alone.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed of myself.
Uh-huh. Does that feel good? No, then you'd try to avoid that somehow. You'd either avoid it by, you know, moving away from the group, or by fighting for your way, or by changing. See, you know, there are different ways to go depending on your personality.
At one point, did the people who do reach that point begin to affirm where they are regardless of
talks at it.
Well, at any point, Gary. Yeah, I mean, you know, it depends on, and we'll get into this with self-image tomorrow, it depends on how the significant adults in your life are treating this. Now, you know, if this was happening to him in school and he could go home and his mother says, don't pay any attention to the kids. You know, if you don't like tomatoes, that's your privilege. I know lots of people don't like tomatoes. That's fine to not like tomatoes. You can be different than the other kids. And he'll say, well, you know, if my mother thinks so, it must be all right, if he values his mother. Okay? So, you know, we'll talk more about that tomorrow, how important that is for the significant adult in a person's life to affirm what they're feeling about stuff and what their individual tastes are. Now, there's some places where it's important to conform, isn't it? You know, and maybe, again, that comes into these three categories, and we need to be sure that we're talking about that. One of the things you can do with little kids to avoid this power struggle that I so often see parents have with kids, and let me tell you, when you get into it at two, or you can get into it already with Jacob by trying to say to him, my will is, you know, my will be done, Jacob, forget it, you know, and two-year-olds are the worst, they are. Because, you know, Jacob is not at an age yet where he really sees himself totally apart from mother yet. You know, he's still too close to that 9 months when he was physically a part of mother. But a two-year-old is now to the point that says, hey, I'm me. And how do I find out that I'm me? I found out by saying no. When somebody wants something, I say no. And they say no and no and no. Even when they mean yes, they are saying no. And if you buck that all the time, you begin to set up a power struggle. And the older the kid gets, the harder that is to deal with, until they get to be about 8 and they can play on the next block, and then you don't hear about it anymore. They just don't tell you what they don't want you to know. And by the time they're teens, you know, they can tell you anything they want you to believe. And if you're not really with it, or the neighbors aren't too talkative, you may. I remember one time two boys brought a dog into my English class. Into our ninth grade English class. Can you imagine? A live dog spent the whole hour in the English class, and this dumb teacher never knew it was there. And she called on us to stand up and read Silas Marner aloud. And when they got called on, the one would simply pass the dog back to the next one, and he would stand up and read Silas Marner and sit down, and that would be called. The dog would get passed, and this woman never even noticed that. Now, you know, this was a case of the kids just bluffing the parents. And this starts, you know, at the very beginning, because everybody wants some autonomy, everybody wants control, and there are ways that you can give kids control that doesn't hurt them. And that's the clue. When we talked about discipline last week, we talked about setting limits where the kid's ability ran out. Within that, encourage divergent thinking so that the child learns how to solve problems when you're still there to help them evaluate. You don't do the evaluating, but you help them to look at these things now and say, okay, that didn't work. Why not? Why do you think it didn't work? But what we generally say is, you stupid kid, cut that out. That's not going to work. And they never get to find out why it doesn't work. Because we know it's not going to work. We don't even let them do it. I remember that, you know, I was the kind of mother who, if the kid left the gym suit at home, I'd barrel over to the school with his gym suit, because don't let the kid make a mistake. He'll get demerits for that. Well, but you see, that was a little mistake. To the kid, it was not any little mistake. Those demerits would have felt rotten. But I mean, ultimately, in the scheme of life, to leave your gym suit home and get a demerit is not too earth-shaking, even though in the fourth grade it may seem that way.
I'll tell you an interesting story about forgetting your gym suit. Dwayne's mom taught him a valuable lesson about forgetting things. He called his mom, what was it, that morning, and said, Mom, I need my gym suit after school for wrestling. And it was done. And she says, where is it? It's down under your clothes. So she had to wash it. So then he comes after school, goes down to the office to pick up his uniform. And here it is in a nice brown with a big ribbon on. Everyone in the office thought it was his birthday. And so, his mom loved him and everything written on his package. And he went down to the gym just in a big rush. And he put his gym suit on. His mother had sewn lace on his gym suit. But I never forgot his gym suit again.
I can imagine that. Just don't look like the lace type somehow.
So that's kind of, you know, lesson.
She did bring it, but she...
Yeah, but she just kind of taught him.
That was
an
uncomfortable way to have to learn.
He remembered that it was down in the dirty clothes.
Yes.
What if mom was
left outside
the home and wasn't able to
Well, interestingly enough, Diane, you know, people are so critical of mothers going to work, but the research that's being done on whether this is a good or bad thing, you know, quote unquote, value judgment, is that kids are really learning a lot from working mothers. I read some research just recently that somebody took a set of home-type mommy bodies and working mommy bodies with their kids, and they gave both groups a game to play in which the way you won was to cooperate. Now, you know, is cooperation a good American value? You know? Well, I don't know, because we value competition so much, and I don't know whether we can have it both ways, but we claim to value cooperation. What they found out was that the mothers who stayed at home tended to be directive and tell their kids what they were to do, and the kids then rebelled and didn't do it. And so those groups lost the game. The mothers who worked outside of the home began brainstorming with the kids on how are we going to get this done, and they did it. Now, you know, why that probably comes about is because those mothers are dependent on those kids to cooperate, or the work doesn't get done. Because all the stuff that mothers used to get their IMs out of doing, they no longer have time to do. The whole family has to do that. Now, if mother is going to take over part of the traditional breadwinning role, then everybody else has to take over part of the traditional mommy role, which was, you know, making beds and shopping and starting dinner and all that kind of thing. So, you know, there maybe is some value to having the women out there doing something else so that everybody has to...
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, he knew mom was there to wash the clothes.
Sure, so and he could depend on her.
If he didn't know that she was there, he maybe would have, when he brought it home the night before, got him clothes.
Yeah, or he would have learned not to forget his gym suit. In what Dreikers refers to as logical consequences. The consequence of forgetting it would have been that he couldn't go to wrestling practice that day, and that probably would have gotten you in lots of trouble, both with the other kids and with the coach, you know. And the kids are mad because the whole team system breaks down. Okay, logical consequences are probably a better way to teach kids than sewing lace on their gym suits, because they are logical. And they're more natural, and they will happen without you having to be the person who does it. I mean, you know, what happened to your feelings toward your mother at that time? Were you grateful to her for having taught this great lesson? You know, whereas if she hadn't been there, or she would have simply said, gosh, I'm sorry, Duane, I don't have time to run down to school with that today. I wasn't planning to do wash today, and I've got other things on my schedule, and you had to do without. It would, you know, may have taught the same lesson. If she was consistent with that, without the, you know, it's a neat example. I don't mean to put down your mom, because obviously she was out to help you.
We were happy to have our young son have to go get his socks and t-shirt this morning in the dining hall.
Yeah, okay. That was a logical consequence. Was he a little embarrassed about that?
I hope so.
Yeah.
But you see,
you didn't have to do it to him, so it didn't set up this power struggle between
yes.
you. It was a logical thing that happened. He forgot them. Some kind soul found them, and so he has them again.
But we haven't talked to him before about that.
Oh, really? Is there anyone here who's never talked to their child about being forgotten? Well, they haven't. Okay. The next level up then, when you have this level of learning through experience and through experiencing a real thing, like the tomato, is that you then have a mental image of that. Or you can see a picture of it and you can understand it. But supposing instead of giving you all these tomatoes, all I had brought here today was a picture of a tomato, and you have never ever in your life experienced a tomato. What could you find out about tomatoes from looking at that picture? Shape and color. Anything else? Could you find out about the seed squirting out of when you squeeze it? You wouldn't know if it was soft? That's right. You wouldn't even know the size, would you? Because it's relative in a picture. You wouldn't know if it was in the picture by itself, if it was as big like this or if it was little like this. Was it a cherry tomato or like a basketball or what? So, you know, the image level is very, very limited. If you have not first had the object level or something to compare it to. You see, if I'd say to you, well, here's a picture of it. It's about the size of an orange. And then you say, oh, okay, I know that. And it's not squishy like an orange. It's squishy inside like an orange, but the skin is thinner than an orange. Then you'd say, oh, okay, I get that. But now what is that learning dependent on? You first have to, you have to first have experienced an orange, because if you've never squished an orange, it doesn't help you to tell you, it doesn't help to tell you it's like an orange, does it? Okay, the top level then is where I can even use these words. When I first said to you tomato, did you get any mental images of tomatoes in your head? What was the first thing, you know, kind of popped into your head when I said tomato? Oh, the a color, something red. Okay, anybody else?
The smell.
The smell, kind of, yes, a taste. Did anybody think of ketchup or pizza or spaghetti sauce or soup? You thought of soup right away. You see, you get these images because you've had all these experiences. So when I say the word, which is only a symbol of a tomato, you can then move back down this this bookcase from, maybe a ladder's a better word. You can move back down to the object through the image because you've had the experience, haven't you? Okay, so the symbol is words, and the image is pictures, and the object is either things or experiences. You can't hold fear in your hand, but you've all had the experience of fear. So when I say the word fear, you know what that is because you've experienced it. And you maybe don't get a mental a picture of it like you did of the redness of the tomato and the soup and all that kind of thing, but you do get a feeling about what that is. Okay, there are ways that we encourage and ways that we discourage creativity in our kids. And I've wanted to go through this rather specifically so that you understood exactly what I mean by creative thinking. Usually when somebody says creativity, we think of the arts, drama, dance, that sort of thing. And yet creative thinking is a gift that we have to apply to absolutely every function of life. When you figure out a way to keep your toddler from turning over when you try to get a diaper on him, when you find a different way to arrange the pots and pans in your kitchen because you got a new one and now it doesn't work anymore, you use creative thinking. We use creative thinking all the time, and yet we deny the fact that we're creative and we only want to apply it to certain very limited areas. And that's because we're afraid of being wrong. You see, so how do we do that? How do we encourage kids to apply their creative thinking powers to all these many, many ways that aren't in these three categories so that life is enriched and we find better solutions to problems? Well, there are more aspects of creative thinking, but we don't have time to go into them. Being original is one, being elaborating on things. Like the Japanese, for instance, are highly creative people, but they never originate stuff. You know, they take things that the Germans have invented or the Americans have invented, but when they get done with it, you know, here's a computer that fills a whole room. 25 years later, the Japanese have it in this little bitsy disk. You know, we didn't do that, but we invented the darn thing in the first place. And that's,
Does that come? My impression of Japanese is they're terribly afraid of being wrong.
Oh,
Their class, society tells them they can't be wrong. And I think that's why they suck so much out of other cultures.
That's right. But then they elaborate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. A little less risky.
That's right. Their culture is one that is very highly proscribed. Like there are 90 ways to say you in the Japanese language. And boy, you better have the right one. I had a friend who was born and raised in the United States, but her parents were Japanese. She married a Japanese national who became a naturalized American. But when his company decided to open an office in Tokyo, he was the natural one to send. So they are now back in Tokyo where he was raised. And she said the first year she was there was absolutely miserable because everyone took her for a Jap rather than a Japanese person rather than an American. And she was, you know, forever committing faux pas because she didn't know all these little minute nuances of their social structure, being an American. And people were, you know, looking down their nose, whereas they're highly forgiving of gaijin or the foreigners, you know. If I make a social mistake, they just laugh it off. It's okay, she's an American.
We have a Japanese man friend who was taught Japanese by his mother, and he found out when we went over to visit the old relatives that there is boy Japanese and girl Japanese, and he learned girl Japanese.
Nice, yes, okay. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, ways. Let me quote some stuff from John Gowan, and then we have a little time to talk about how you can structure your home to be more creative. We'll do that. Let me find this here. Okay, parenting creatively implies that you are ready to modify techniques which acquaint children with facts in favor of stimulating them to think. See, that's the difference. When you're dealing with the first category there, you tell facts. But with the second kind of stuff, you stimulate kids to think and solve problems. This involves a couple things that are real hard for us to do. One of them is sharing power with kids. And for instance, if you've got a two-year-old, one of the things you can allow choices on is what they're going to have for lunch. But you don't say to the two-year-old, what do you want for lunch? And then he says a Hershey bar, and then you say, well, you can't have that. Don't give choices where there really aren't any, but give lots of choices where there are choices. You can say, let's see, what do we have in the icebox today? Well, we have cheese, we have a can of tuna fish, and we've got some roast beef left from last night. Which of those three would you like for your lunch? Well, then the child has to evaluate. You see, which one do I want and why do I want it? And then they have to live with their own choice. Sometimes I find parents of preschoolers get in terrible trouble with what the kid's going to wear. You know, there's this big fight. I had a child who used to come to school, the nursery school, just in a tizzy, almost half the mornings. One morning he came in so angry. I said, Doug, what are you so angry about this morning? She won't let me wear my cowboy suit because I wore it Tuesday. So when the mother came in for conference, I said, you know, I really don't care. He can wear that cowboy suit every day of the week if it makes him happy. What's the difference? You know, just let him wear what he wants. She says, he can wear whatever he wants. And I thought, oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the trouble was that grandma was in the picture with this one. And you know those Polly Flinders trunk sales that you can go down and you pick out these handmade, hand-smocked dresses for, you know, an arm and a leg apiece? Well, this grandma went down and said, I'll have the trunk. She didn't just pick out a dress, just give me the trunk. You know, she bought these kids' dresses, and mother had to make sure they all got worn and the little suits and stuff. So there was always this big argument. Mother had a lot of ego, and grandma was pressuring mother with her ego to be sure these kids looked like little models when they arrived at school, which is really not too appropriate for nursery school. Going to nursery school is like going to work. You know, if you work as a car mechanic, you do not wear a gray flannel suit. That's an inappropriate garment. And I think Polly Flinders dresses are inappropriate to wear in nursery school. You need something you can get paint and clay and stuff on. But you can give the child the choice by you doing the shopping. You know, these are your school clothes. Which outfit would you like to wear today? And if the favorite one's in the wash, well, that's too bad. You'll have to live with that. And if they throw a tantrum about that, well, there's nothing you can do about that until I have to wash it.
Our daughter, on the way to handle it, that she might be all right. She teaches her children very much to make decisions. She wants them to learn how to make decisions. And yet, she still wants them to know that once in a while, mother has some authority, you know, in this. So she has them taking turns with her. They have a choice 1 week or a day. And then she helps them. She gets to do it another day.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Well, you know, so if you're really uptight about matching colors and stuff like that, I have a feeling that you can teach the child that from little on. What goes with what? You know, here's a new dress. What do we buy to go with it? Or here's a pair of pants. What do we buy to go with it? Or you structure it and it doesn't matter, you know, you don't buy two pairs of plaid pants and two pairs of plain ones and two striped shirts and two plain ones and then get mad when the kid wears a striped shirt with a plaid pant because you don't think that matches. You buy all plain tops and all plaid bottoms or vice versa, and then it doesn't matter. You know, and if you buy blue things and brown things, they can put them together. But if you're going to buy, you know, stuff that doesn't go together, and you have a problem if you get gifts, I'm sure. But you can talk to the child and help them to see why you are evaluating it this particular way. Okay, so, you know, giving up some of the power and letting kids have power where they're capable of handling it. And I'm not talking about taking away all the limits, because that doesn't help kids any more than you controlling everything. They need to have limits where they're incapable of making decisions. But I feel like, you know, we often make decisions where kids really can do it because our own ego is so involved. We're afraid what the neighbors will say or what my mother-in-law will say if this kid doesn't look like a little model or is not clean. You know, oh, please don't try to keep your kids clean up here. They just cannot have fun up here and stay clean. There's no way. Okay. The other side of that coin of giving up some of the power is then expecting children to be responsible for their own behavior. You see, you have to have those expectations for them. And then to risk, you know, allowing them to make some mistakes, like forgetting their gym suit, and it's okay. It's okay with me. I will not have to downgrade my own feelings about who I am and say, well, I'm a really terrible mother because my child forgot his gym suit. Those things are kind of scary, I think, for most of us as parents to contemplate. Some things that you can consider in an effort to encourage creativity are time, for instance. How can you encourage a child to stick with a project or an activity long enough to allow for creative processes to occur? It takes time to be creative, and this is one of the biggest things that gets in our way as parents, you see, because they don't do it quick enough if we let them do the decision making, and we want it to happen right away. Are there built-in rewards for thinking creatively? How can you facilitate postponing closure on their thinking? One of the things we do is wanting this instant answer, you know, what's the right answer right away? And how can you get them to wait a while before they make up their minds, which of the five things they thought of is going to be the best? And so that they have time to think, for the creative process to take place. One example that I like to think of is putting toys away because it's bedtime. You know, we do this so much at school. It is cleanup time. Well, why is it cleanup time? Well, at school you have to clean up because another group's going to use that, or you need the space for a group activity that somebody just built this marvelous creation in, and so you have to do that. But I think at home you can be a lot more flexible with that. We used to have a rule at our house that if no one had played with it for 3 days, we might entertain the thought of dismantling it and putting it away. Now, sometimes entertaining the thought of dismantling a Tinker Toy Tower got somebody to elaborate on it and say, oh, yeah, maybe I'd like to play with this some more. So then the thing goes on up or out or whatever, and you get some more play value out of something, whereas it would have just stood there if you hadn't said anything about, that stood there long enough. Maybe, you know, Saturday being the day when everybody vacuums or straightens up their stuff is enough. But if there's some really super project, you see, I like to put it to parents this way. I don't know how, this is not a male-oriented project so much, but I guess it's one that I can identify with because I like to sew my own clothes. But if you're a man, maybe you can imagine this as a woodworking project. Supposing you got a project going, you're going to make something, and all of a sudden you realize it's dinner time, you've got to quit. So you take apart all the things that you've already done. You know, if you're making a dress, you have to rip out all the stitches and fold it all up and put it back on the shelf. Okay, dinner's over, dishes are done, and oh, I've got 2 hours before bedtime. You get it out and you start over and get a little farther this time. But it's time to go to bed, I have to take it apart. So you take out all the stitches, you know, take the, I don't know what you do about buttonholes you've already cut, but you know, you have to take it all apart again and put it away. How many dresses do you think you'd finish if you had to do it like that? And yet we do this with kids all the time. You know, instead of saying that's half finished, here's a place to keep it so you can come back to it. Or providing children with a mess place. I mean, you know, how many men have a workbench someplace in the garage or the basement where they can keep unfinished, half-finished projects to come back to them the next time they have time? Now, how many women lament because they got to sew on the dining room table or do their hobby or something? You know, if you really want kids to be creative, or if you want to be creative, you have to have a place where it is legitimate for messes to live. Now, I have problems at our house because the messes seem to want to go like the creeping plague, so that the entire house is engulfed in mess. And I feel like, you know, we each have a room to mess in. Let's confine the mess there in the space that we share can be kept tidy. You know, take making dinner as an example. How can you possibly make dinner without messing up the kitchen? You know, but you just take it for granted that part of making dinner is cleaning up. The dishes end in the dishwasher, back in the closet. The food ends up back in the refrigerator or in our stomachs. You know, we'd never eat if we never could make a mess. And we provide a whole room for making that mess because we make it 3 times a day, or at least 2 times a day. Well, let's go for one. Not at all. I mean, houses in our culture and most cultures are built with a place to make a food. Well, that is half of my talk on creativity. Thanks for being good listeners.